your university, you probably assume that the information you are getting is of the highest, most objective caliber, which means you tend to believe it. But when the University of Chicago gave its recent symposium called Nuclear Reaction, and you hear a genuine expert on all things nuclear, such as Dave Kraft of the Nuclear Energy Information Service, say,
"It was probably one of the most intellectually dishonest symposium I've ever seen at an institution of higher learning. It was nothing but a propaganda statement for the nuclear industry, which is desperately trying to stay alive, and it is marshaling all its allies in academia, in government, in the military, to put across this false notion that somehow nuclear power is going to make our grid more reliable, where the evidence points to the contrary."
Well, when you hear countering information like that, you begin to understand how the public's understanding of nuclear has been twisted, and how that contributes to the intense global warming of that seat we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a special full-length report on the University of Chicago's events congratulating itself for the creation of the first atomic chain reaction 75 years ago. We'll be featuring the perspectives of Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education and Nuclear Energy Information Service, NEIS, Executive Director Dave Kraft, and many attending board members. It's a through-the-looking-glass journey into what the nuclear industry says and what those who oppose them know as the larger truth. Plus, a taste of two presentations by Arne Gunderson and one by Dr. Norma Field for a human and humane perspective on nuclear and the economics of nuclear in light of the climate change argument. Of course, it wouldn't be Nuclear Hot Seat without Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and we'll be presenting more honest nuclear information than the audience at the University of Chicago's December 2nd event heard in a full-day symposium. All of this is coming up right now. Today is Tuesday, December 5th, 2017, and here is the nuclear news from a different perspective. The University of Chicago pulled out all the stops to celebrate the 75th anniversary of their achievement of the first controlled atomic reaction, referred to as Chicago Pile 1, or CP1. It took place under the stands of their abandoned football field, and it marked the true start of the nuclear nightmare in which we now live. The high point in the university's month-long celebration was a one-day symposium entitled Nuclear Reaction. It featured former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz giving the keynote, an interview panel that included Chris Crane, the president and CEO of Exelon Corporation, representatives drawn from the Department of Energy, the military, and the university itself, and what appeared to be a very large budget. I had wanted to include audio from the University of Chicago symposium, but my recordings, made three rows back from the stage on an iPhone, were not usable. And despite repeated requests to the university's several communications departments, audio was not made available to me by the time of this recording. So instead of having you hear what some members of the nuclear establishment were saying, This narrative will consist of the questions, challenges, and thoughts of those who attended, understood what was going on, and spoke their truth to power for the record. By listening to them and their spot-on analyses, I'm sure you can reverse engineer the content of the events. As we were waiting for the symposium to begin, I spoke with Gail Snyder, a board member of NEIS, to find out why she and all the others had chosen to attend such a blatantly nuclear-supporting event.
You know, this is the spot where it all began, and Illinois and the world has been impacted by everything that started here back in the 40s. And the University of Chicago, although there are some people who are, you know, concerned about what's happening with nuclear power in particular, they're a little bit more focused on nuclear weapons. And I am concerned about what is going to be said here about nuclear power. I'm concerned about what the former head of the Department of Energy, Secretary Moniz, is going to be saying about nuclear power. I know he likes to say that it's clean, and he likes to use the term technology neutral to justify why we can use nuclear power to justify clean energy.
And what do you think of that justification?
I think it's horrible. I think it totally negates the fact that nuclear power is one of the energy sources, the only energy source really that has an emergency planning zone, can cause a nuclear disaster, and all of these things combined make it unsafe for people to use nuclear power. Now, he wants to incentivize nuclear power because he calls it carbon neutral and a low carbon supplier of energy, but he never talks about the radiation, the nuclear accidents. He never talks about the Price-Anderson Act and how really we've already subsidized nuclear in effect by limiting their liability, capping it using the Price-Anderson Act. So, you know, if you had a vehicle and somebody said, I want you to be my driver, and you said, well, I think it's a little risky to drive in the area you want me to drive, and they said, well, you know what, you'll only have to pay up to $100 of any accident. If you crash into a school bus and you take everybody out, we'll cover the cost for you. Well, that's a pretty good incentive to keep doing what you're doing, and that's really what the Price-Anderson Act does for the nuclear industry to keep running their nuclear power plants. And now he's talking about incentivizing them more. So we've already incentivized them by reducing their liability. Now he wants to incentivize them because they're not profitable and they can't compete. And he's still not talking about radiation.
Gail Snyder, board member of NEIS. We'll hear more from Gail shortly. The event, Nuclear Reactions, opened with a short, well-produced film that set the self-congratulatory stage for the anniversary commemoration. The historian scheduled to follow up with a more detailed telling of the story was ill, but his speech was read by another academician. It provided a rather cute retelling of the story of the first atomic pile, called a pile for its resemblance to a biological pile, and included such details as the physically wimpy scientist needing help wrestling the 60-pound graphite bricks into place to surround the nuclear material and having them worked on by college football team members who were trying to make extra money to support their schooling. This was told as a joke and got the biggest laugh of the day. He also spoke about how the clicks on the radiation monitor rose to a steady hum as the pile went critical, and the toasting of its success with Chianti, not unlike the Hannibal Lecter character in Silence of the Lambs. Next came the first of three panel discussions. It was entitled, The Role of Nuclear Energy in a Climate-Constrained World. Moderated by civil rights attorney and former media personality Gretchen Helfrich, it featured the president and CEO of nuclear operator Exelon Corporation and a University of Chicago economics professor, Michael Greenstone. To get a sense of what was not part of their discussion, here are two questions asked from the floor during the very brief open Q&A. In the first, Stephen Sondheim, a member of both NEIS and the Sierra Club Nuclear Free campaign, took the mic.
Hi, my name is Stephen Sondheim. I got three points that I want to comment on. I'm really tired of hearing that nuclear is carbon-free. It is not carbon-free. In my research and research of other people, from cradle to grave, it's up to 25 or 30% of the carbon of a gas plant. It's not carbon-free. Let's stop doing that. Because all of a sudden, that just gives it a free ride on that. Secondly, on the notion of renewables costing 10 times, which was a reference, I don't think that's so. I've watched renewable prices come down to 2 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour for wind, to 4 to 6 cents for solar. I've seen storage on the verge of happening. And the problem with the economics is that it's not only the cost of nuclear and the fact that it does get heavily subsidized, $3 billion here to save two nuclear plants, $8 billion in New York, and moves to subsidize by the Department of Energy scores of nuclear power plants in that way. But it's the opportunity costs. If we looked at that $3 billion or $8 billion and pushed renewable hard, my contention is we'd be towards a carbon-less world much quicker. Thank you.
Stephen Sondheim of both NEIS and the Sierra Club, but alas, not Broadway, speaking truth to power. Gail Snyder stood up and got in a well-composed zinger of a question.
And Mr. Crane, you had mentioned merging economic, environmental, and environmental policy. And Mr. Greenstone, you had mentioned the challenge of really how to compensate people and for some people to take the hit for technology. I haven't heard either of you address nuclear power accidents. I haven't heard Fukushima brought up, or Chernobyl, or the impacts of uranium minings on American Indian communities. So I'd like to know where the negative impact of nuclear power fits into the calculus of how energy should be chosen. And it really is being excluded from this argument of carbon. And we cannot talk about energy being clean and base it only on carbon without talking about these extremely negative impacts when nuclear goes wrong.
NEIS board member Gail Snyder. Besides joining her voice to the others who were outraged at the lack of acknowledgement of the dangers of nuclear power, another NEIS board member, Jan Boudard, brought up another important point.
Chris Crane, the Exelon president, did not mention any of the negative aspects of nuclear power. And for me, the biggest omission is the cost of the fuel cycle, the accidents that have happened in the mining and the milling of uranium fuel, and the fact that I've become acquainted pretty well with several of the Diné who live in the Four Corners area and are suffering from the effects of this industrialization. And one of them, Leona Morgan, says, you may run into an old coal miner, but you'll never run into an old uranium miner. The Native Americans are paying the price for the mining and milling of the nuclear fuel.
NEIS board member Jan Boudard. The second panel discussion on the role of nuclear weapons in the modern world, don't get me started, featured as panelists Madeline Creedon, former principal deputy director, National Nuclear Security Administrator, U.S. Department of Energy. The other participant, Dennis Blair. Research has revealed that Mr. Blair is actually former Admiral Dennis Blair, whose impressive credits include former Director of National Intelligence, where he led 16 national intelligence agencies, managed a budget of $50 billion, and provided integrated intelligence support to the President, Congress, and operations in the field. Before retiring from his 34-year naval career in 2002, Blair served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Command. Thus, I found it fascinating that on the University of Chicago's program, he was listed simply as Chairman of Sasakawa Peace Foundation, USA, a position he currently holds, but not quite the full picture of the man who was on the stage. The panel discussion went as you would expect. During the very brief Q&A, I'd wanted to ask a question about the importance of the UN's treaty to ban nuclear weapons, the existence of which was never acknowledged. Unfortunately, I just missed being called on by the moderator. Fortunately, immediately afterwards, during a break in the proceedings, I had the good fortune to run into panelist Madeline Creedon. The fact that I ran into her in the ladies' room made absolutely no difference to me, and when she gave me an incredulous look, as I suggested we speak right then and there, as I simultaneously blocked her exit and held the mic up to her mouth, I replied, "Isn't that how men have traditionally networked?" Here's our exchange.
My question is, on July 7th of this year, the United Nations passed a treaty for a nuclear ban, making the weapons illegal. It's now in the ratification process for the many nations, the 122 nations that were there. It needs 50 signatures. Does that show up in official quarters as more than a minor blip on the radar or a punchline of a naive joke?
So the NPR is the, or the NPT is the fundamental document that underlies nonproliferation, and that goal, as we discussed earlier, is the ultimate commitment on the part of the recognized nuclear weapons state to have serious discussions. So I think what the new BN treaty reflects is it reflects a frustration on the non-weapon states that the weapons states aren't moving fast enough.
Excuse me. If we can get that.
You want to go outside?
Let's go outside.
So I think what the BN treaty reflects is it reflects a frustration at some level of non-nuclear weapon states, their frustration with nuclear weapon states not going faster in terms of their reductions, and also frustration with states who are not recognized nuclear weapon states under the NPT, like India, Pakistan, and now North Korea since they pulled out, that they're still continuing to develop nuclear weapons and build more.
Do you think that the ban treaty is going to ultimately have any impact?
Certainly not without the signatures of the nuclear weapon states, and none of the nuclear weapon states have signed it.
Madeline Creedon, who was immediately whisked away by her handlers. The closing keynote address was delivered by former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz. It was, as one might expect, and we'll have comments on his remarks that put it into perspective from Arne Gunderson, among others, in a few moments. The next day, Saturday, December 2nd, I caught up with Dave Kraft, Executive Director of NEIS, for his reflections on the University of Chicago Symposium, as well as the planned events NEIS was co-hosting at DePaul University.
Dave, what was your response to the program at the University of Chicago yesterday?
There were two parts to the response. The first is we understood it was a birthday party and everyone's going to be celebrating, and nobody says bad things at a birthday party. I mean, unless the mean uncle shows up and you know, does nasty things in the punch bowl. Well, we showed up. And the first presentation by Christopher Crane of Exelon Corporation and Michael, I think it was Goldberg, from the economics department at University of Chicago, was probably one of the most intellectually dishonest symposium I've ever seen at an institution of higher learning. It was nothing but a propaganda statement for the nuclear industry, which is desperately trying to stay alive, and it is marshaling all its allies in academia, in government, in the military, to put across this false notion that somehow nuclear power is going to make our grid more reliable, where the evidence points to the contrary. And I guess one of the more ironic things that happened between yesterday and today was at the very moment that Chris Crane was saying that, yes, it would be nice if we had renewables, but we need a reliable utility-scale storage to make it happen, and that's far away. At that very moment in Australia, Elon Musk opened up a 150-megawatt utility-scale storage system, which the Australian government is praising left and right as promoting grid stability, and he did it a month and a half ahead of schedule. This is something that Exelon never did when they built their reactors. So the irony is incredible here. The doublethink, the deliberate misinformation that was put into that 40 minutes of disingenuous grapefruits in terms of questions and whatever pitched to those guys was just appalling for the University of Chicago. They really should be discredited, however you take away academic credentials for that show. The second important piece, though, about the event yesterday, December 1st at University of Chicago, is we came down there as a counterbalance, a counterpoint message that the nuclear age has not been kind to everybody. It isn't just all roses and flowered fields and too cheap to meter electricity, none of which ever happened. We're here to announce that the nuclear age is over, and it's being replaced by what we call the age of decommissioning. This is the age where responsible adults have to stand up and say, now we have to clean up the crap of the last 75 years, which we've left lying around the world. The 450 nuclear reactors and all of their spent fuel and all of their nuclear waste and the tens of thousands of uranium mines on indigenous lands in the Western United States, Western Canada, Africa, Australia. The age of decommissioning is here, and responsible adults will take that to heart and do something about it and recognize that we shouldn't add to the problem by expanding nuclear.
So today we are in a different university with obviously a different financial set of backing, given that we are in much more modest circumstances than the University of Chicago's illustrious building that we were in. What are we here for, and what are you hoping to accomplish with it?
Today's program at DePaul University on the north side of Chicago is titled, Where Are the People? And it comes from a question that one of our friends and colleagues from University of Chicago broached about 6 years ago, shortly after the Fukushima disaster. We heard all about RADs and REMs and machines and cleanup and bags and governments. And she finally got so exasperated, she blurted out in a question session of one of these illustrious academic meetings, I've heard you talk for hours. Where are the people? You haven't talked about the people. You haven't talked about the victims. You haven't talked about the 150,000 who lost their homes. And she very justifiably lost it. And we've kept that theme going for the last 6 years. And that's what today is about. Today is about where are the people. We're going to talk about all of the unnamed victims of the nuclear age in one form or another, specifically focusing on Fukushima, probably because that's the most recent disaster. But acknowledging the fact that people matter. You know, half-lives trumping full lives is really, really immoral. And that's what we're here today, is to affirm the fact that humanity is a grouping of full lives, and nuclear was supposed to serve humanity and not the other way around, which is what's happened. So we're here to turn it around and say it the way it should be said.
Dave Kraft, Executive Director of NEIS. The event Dave spoke of was Where Are the People? The Human Toll of the Nuclear Age, presented at DePaul University, chaired by DePaul Associate Professor Yuki Miyamoto, who is from Hiroshima and whose mother was on the ground in the city where the first atomic bomb was dropped. Two brief excerpts from these presentations. The first is from a PowerPoint presentation by Arne Gunderson.
These are clothes from a Fukushima Daiichi worker, not somebody who was in the plant, but somebody who was working on the piles of the bag piles. And we have a complete set of his clothes, his socks, his boots, his gloves, his undergloves, his pants, his shirt, and the cross-hatching, the safety cross-hatching that he wore. When we analyzed it, we found out that it was highly radioactive. Now, these people are recruited for these jobs from throughout Japan, and they go home on weekends. And we found that the most highly radioactive piece of his clothing was his crotch. Mm-hmm. Think about that. So these guys are leaving the prefecture on a weekly basis to go home to their families. And you can't tell me that some of the contamination on the clothing does not get either imbibed or stuck to their skin as well.
We'll present the audio from this entire presentation on a future nuclear hot seat. The other presenter on Where Are the People? The Human Toll of the Nuclear Age was Dr. Norma Field. She is a Robert Ingersoll Distinguished Service Professor Emerita of Japanese Studies at the University of Chicago and a frequent media commentator on the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Here is a brief excerpt from Dr. Field's presentation.
One of the lasting legacies of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs is discrimination against the victims. So the victims are twice victimized. they've had the bombs inflicted on them, and then they have to worry about their children and grandchildren suffering from discrimination in marriage and employment. And this immediately became a hot topic in Fukushima after the disaster. We hear about cars with Fukushima plates being trashed, keyed, whatnot. Parents trying to get their children to boarding schools outside at a very early age. This is not a common practice in Japan because they want their children to break any bureaucratic record of their children's ties to Fukushima canceled early on so that they won't suffer. So one of the things science has begun to say, and we get that from that slide that Arnie showed, is if you continue to be unscientific and keep expressing your worries about health and about the safety of our food products, you're just inviting discrimination against Fukushima, right? Don't be unscientific, don't worry about health, and don't be a discriminating jerk, right? Think about your fellow Fukushima citizens and stop talking about worries. You can imagine what kind of pressure this creates on people living in Fukushima who might be worried too.
Dr. Norma Field, and we will be using her complete presentation on a nuclear hot seat in the near future. This event took place on Saturday, December 2nd, and was not without its University of Chicago component, which brings me to
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
How did the University of Chicago choose to mark the exact moment of the anniversary of the start of the atomic age? Well, how else? With fireworks! And not just the red, white, and blue spasms we've come to expect every 4th of July. An artistic display, crafted exclusively for this one event, exploded over the site of the first atomic pile and representing the infamous atomic mushroom-shaped cloud. Only this was no fireball of death. It was beautiful. Multicolored streaks shot straight up from the ground zero like independent missiles, and a separate set of coordinated explosions set off hundreds of individual color bursts that spread into the sky, assuming the shape of the mushroom top part of the mushroom cloud. It was a cartoon of a happy nuclear bomb blast sketched into the sky. And those colors, as they expanded, they even looked like little origami cranes. Perhaps a hidden cry for peace by the artist, a sign that he knew the truth of how his artistry had been co-opted, even as it had to be funded. But I do not blame the artist for accepting the commission. After all, who but corporations, war profiteers, and the academic institutions that support them have the money to underwrite such a unique and expensive art form? But look at the intent of the University of Chicago in seeking out this artist and paying what must have been a significant amount of money for him to create his art on such a grand scale and in service to what? A nuclear bomb? What fun it must have been for them to decide that, yes, let's transmute the fireball, the inferno, the deadly nuclear holocaust of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that all started with CP1 into a colorful artistic fireworks display that wisps away in mere minutes, leaving behind nothing. In contrast to the real mushroom clouds from Fat Boy and Little Man, the atomic bombs that killed a combined estimated total of over 225,000 people, either instantaneously or in the immediate aftermath of the explosions. And that's not counting the countless numbers more in years that followed, from radiation exposure, genetic damage, and despair. A pretty nuclear explosion? What a grotesque contradiction in terms. What a tone-deaf demonstration of hubris, arrogance, and nuclear presumption. And that is why you, University of Chicago, and the evil PR geniuses who thought up this particular stunt on your behalf, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
By the way, the visual ID for this week's Nuclear Hot Seat number 337, the featured photo on the site, is a picture of those fireworks at their full height. We'll continue with this special report in just a few moments, but first, it will be no surprise to you that Nuclear Hot Seat relies on donations to help us with our coverage of all things nuclear from a different perspective. If you are enjoying this perspective on the University of Chicago's celebration of the first atomic pile, as well as the information you're going to be getting in the rest of this program, help us out with the donation. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's to make a one-time donation of any size, as well as set up a recurring donation. Or for the budget model that really helps us out with our planning, you can set up a monthly $5 donation, the amount of a cup of coffee and a nice tip to the barista. That's something you can accomplish by clicking on the big green donate button. Either way, know that you are helping to get out the word about nuclear issues around the world that don't usually get heard, and that are sent out with accuracy, footnotes, and journalistic verification. For all the help you can give us in making that a reality, I am truly grateful. On Sunday, December 3rd, Arne Gundersen again gave a presentation, this time at the Third Unitarian Church near the University of Chicago. He started with the best explanation of the mechanism of global warming that I have ever heard, and then followed the money to reveal the reality behind the nuclear industry's climate change, carbon-free argument in favor of nukes, to reveal what nuclear reactors really do contribute to the carbon-free argument. Here's just a brief sample.
We used nuclear industry data from one of their international websites, and the real answer is, if we didn't have all those nukes, there would be 1 gigaton more for all of them. 1 gigaton more would be thrown into the atmosphere, or 3%. Nukes are only eliminating 3% of the carbon dioxide that's getting thrown into the atmosphere now. And that's all of them. That's all 450 of them.
Worldwide,
450 worldwide nukes. And in the U.S., we've got 100. In Illinois, I think you've got 18. Is that right?
11 operating.
11 operating, okay. Then what you do is you take 3% and you divide it by 450, and each nuclear power plant is reducing global gases into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, by 0.007%, 0.007%. So when you hear that argument that, oh my God, if we shut down Quad Cities, all the polar bears are going to die, it's just not true. It's an inconsequential amount.
I consider the content of Arne's talk so important that it will be run in its entirety next week on Nuclear Hot Seat number 338. To wind up the weekend, I sat down with Arne Gundersen for a post-mortem on the University of Chicago events and what he saw as the flaws in the information that was presented.
What was your overall impression of the event put on by the University of Chicago?
I was not impressed. It was basically an infomercial for the nuclear industry. They have the Argonne National Labs nearby, and there's a long history of supporting nuclear power through research and development. So I guess I should not have been surprised. But what seemed like a good idea 75 years ago is not now, and I don't think anybody really admitted that. As Forbes said back in the 80s, this has been the biggest managerial disaster in the history of business. I had hoped that they would have portrayed the painting, the panorama of nuclear power more thoroughly, in more depth. And in fact, they glossed over disasters like Chernobyl and Fukushima, the destruction of indigenous lands from mining, and, oh, by the way, what are we going to do with the nuclear waste? None of that came out. They focused on the intellectual achievement of creating a nuclear criticality, which was an intellectual achievement. But when you look at where it led, I think it's been an academic black hole.
Let's get into some specifics here. In the opening film history that was shown, giving a short version of how the pile came about, it stated that long-lived radionuclides could be treated so that they would only be radioactive for 300 years, not 300,000-plus years, meaning the nuclear waste that is created. And this was also picked up by Chris Crane, the head of Exelon. What were they talking about?
You know, in the nuclear business, there's always another gimmick, and this is just another gimmick. We've been at this for 75 years, and reactors have gotten bigger and smaller and changed from uranium to thorium and on. There's always another way to repackage nuclear power. And apparently, a few academicians have come up with a process that works on paper that shows that you can split uranium in such a way that it doesn't produce plutonium. I don't know how that can be. And again, you know, it's the difference between theory and in practice. And in theory, there's no difference between practice and theory. In practice, there is.
Radioactive waste was one of those topics that just kind of didn't make it onto the stage during that time. And Chris Crane even said repeatedly that nuclear was carbon-free and inexhaustible. Give us some interpretation of that, Arnie.
Well, I guess I'd like to take Mr. Crane on a trip to Fukushima, and we can talk about nuclear waste contaminating hillsides the size of the state of Connecticut to truly understand what can happen when things go wrong. What upset me about Mr. Crane's presentation was this hubris that, you know, we know where the safety limits are and we stay within that box all the time. And those people over in Japan were, it's a corporate culture thing. He never addressed the fact that that plant was built by Americans, Sebasco and General Electric. And they were playing in the box that Americans designed and is identical to the box that Dresden, right, 40 miles from Chicago, is built to. So the hubris of the nuclear executives in dealing with older nuclear power, they just don't understand that you can't continually repair an old car. It gets older and will break sooner or later. That's what I find most frightening.
The term nuclear externalities was used repeatedly during the discussions, and it seems like an intentionally vague and imprecise term, though it was obviously languaging used to cover up something more pointed. What are externalities, or what were they talking about?
I think what he was discussing was, what should have been discussed, was the desecration of native lands for uranium mining, the destruction of entire villages and cities like Chernobyl and Fukushima. You know, all those inconvenient things that you really don't want to address, and you certainly don't want in your backyard, are externalities. It's a nice term to avoid discussing the horrid aspects of nuclear power, and I think it's just aids in this cover up.
There seem to, on occasion, be little slips coming from the stage that inadvertently spoke against nuclear, even by the people who are supposed to be the proponents. For example, Michael Greenstone, an economist from the University of Chicago, actually said the words, "The economics are terrible for nuclear." Do you think maybe those were hidden cries for help, or what do you think explains or frames those kind of statements and any of the others that you might remember?
Well, there's two issues there. The first is building a new nuke makes no economic sense. And not only did Mr. Greenstone say that, but so did Crane. They said, you know, you have to have a death wish to build a nuclear power plant now, a new nuke. But the other issue is the old nukes are also more expensive than renewables or more expensive than natural gas. And basically, Crane was lobbying for a subsidy. Now, he may call it something else, but basically it was yet another subsidy for nuclear power. This is the most subsidized industry in the history of business. You know, the plants were all over budget when they were finished. So the ratepayers ate that. And then in the 90s, there was as these plants got spun off, there was another loss to the ratepayers that they paid. And now here we are 20 years later, and Exelon and others are lining up for yet another subsidy to keep these plants running. there's a saying I think applies that, well, these plants should be shut down rather than continue to be subsidized. But the famous saying is that pigs get fed, but hogs get slaughtered. And it's time to shut these things down.
The keynote speaker for this event was Ernest Moniz, the former Secretary of Energy, which I find interesting that everybody still referred to him as the Energy Secretary as opposed to putting the word former in there. Maybe that was just wishful thinking. I don't know. But in any event, he spoke for over half an hour and hit many of the points that we've been hearing in the nuclear industry. Arnie, give us your feedback on former Secretary Moniz's speech.
I think he just mirrored the position of Department of Energy while he was there. You know, he's an MIT professor, and MIT's nuclear department is notoriously pro-nuclear. I mean, these guys have a Tokyo Electric seat, and somebody pays for Tokyo Electric pays for a professor at MIT. So they are clearly pro-nuclear, and he can't admit to himself that the future is going to be different than the past. I have no problem with him supporting the fact that we built nuclear power in the 70s and it may or may not have been the right decision, but we're stuck with it. But for him to continually double down, which is what Department of Energy is doing, always a new gimmick, I don't understand where brilliant minds like that can't appreciate that it's time to close this technology and move on as opposed to doubling down with a new bet.
Were there any specific omissions that he made or statements that he made that pushed the envelope?
Well, he was suggesting that renewables are more highly subsidized than nuclear. And there's actually a study, I think it's a General Accounting Office study, that shows that over the last 70 years, nuclear has eaten more than half of the R&D pie, and coal and oil have eaten another third, and corn to power has eaten another eighth, leaving about 5 or 10% for the renewable pie. So to claim that renewables are in favor and poor nuclear is not getting the subsidies it deserves. From a historical perspective, it's just absolutely wrong.
There were certain words that I noticed were not spoken from the stage while the event was going on, including such words as radiation, atomic, and you had an interesting point about atomic versus nuclear, and also UN nuclear bomb treaty. What would be the significance, say, of not using the word radiation or not using the word atomic?
Well, Maggie, my wife, has studied this concept. It used to be called the Atomic Energy Commission, and the first nuclear reactor was the Shippingport Atomic Power Plant. And the nuclear industry realized when they polled people that atomic scared the hell out of people, so they changed the word to nuclear. And when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was created, it dropped the concept of atomic. When people think of atomic, they think of bombs. When they think of nuclear, they think it's safe and green and things like that. So it's definitely another marketing ploy that the industry has used, not just within the industry, but here's the federal government jumping on that bandwagon. I didn't hear radiation either. You know, we look at the heat from the chain reaction, and when the uranium splits, there's an enormous amount of heat, and that's where scientists stop. But what they forget about are these two pieces that it split into, which this radioactive rubble, and they remain radioactive for centuries. And I think it's academically dishonest to talk about how powerful splitting the uranium is and then not say, oh, by the way, we've created waste that's going to last a half a million years.
Anything else that you noticed that was left out from the stage?
You know, when you're around 45 years like me, you see these trends. And the reactor I was licensed on was called the ALCO reactor, which is for the American Locomotive Company. And yes, they had actually planned to put a small nuclear reactor onto a locomotive. Now we're back to small reactors again. And in the meantime, reactors have gone from small to 600 megawatts to 800 to 1,000 to 1,200. And now there's one in Pennsylvania that might be 1,600 megawatts. Now the industry says, oh my God, the solution is small modular reactors. And we're right back to where we were 70 years ago. It didn't work 70 years ago. Small modular reactors didn't work 70 years ago. And I guess they think enough people have died and forgotten about it, they're going to try that stunt again.
Secretary Moniz talked about the desire or the need to merge energy policy and environmental policy. Is that feasible? Is that desirable? Or is there some subtext to that that most of us are missing right now?
I think he was. There was a subtext that we were missing. And basically he's suggesting that, yeah, nuclear is expensive, but it should be subsidized because it doesn't produce as much carbon dioxide as a coal plant. And I think that's what he was really getting at, that there are benefits beyond electricity that come from nuclear power. So when he talked about merging energy policy with that, he was just looking for another subsidy for nuclear power. And there's another sham in there, too. You know, they say, well, nuclear produces less carbon dioxide than coal. What they don't say is that nuclear plants devour water, two or three times more water to cool them than a coal or a natural gas plant. The Indian Point plants on the Hudson River use 10% of the entire flow of the Hudson River to cool them. So every fish egg and every small critter in that river is killed when it runs through that condenser. 10% of the living things in that river get destroyed by that power plant. And the same with Tennessee Valley Authority. And the thermal pollution from a nuclear plant is much worse. They don't want to talk about that, but they want to talk about the fact that they reduce carbon dioxide.
There were repeated statements, I believe it was from Secretary Moniz, saying that it was all right to give nuclear technology to, quote, responsible nuclear countries, those that would be safe, sane, and reliable, and that would add up to security. Is that as ridiculous as it sounds to me?
You know, we gave nuclear technology to India and Pakistan, and they created bombs on both sides of a very sensitive border. And North Korea has nuclear technology, and they've created bombs too. No, nuclear reactors in the process of making a chain reaction from low-enriched uranium create plutonium. And a good chemist can rip those nuclear fuel rods apart, strip out the plutonium, and make a bomb. With IAEA oversight, it's just not enough, because if a country decides to make a bomb program, they just throw the IAEA inspectors out and live with sanctions and build their own bomb. You can build a bomb anywhere in the world by extracting the plutonium that's left over when you fission nuclear power.
So each one of these nuclear reactors is, in essence, a producer of the material that's used for the bomb.
Yes, and it just takes a smart chemist to split it out. You know, when we started the Manhattan Project, we had these diffusion plants to enrich uranium. But what a nuclear reactor allows you to do is to skip that. You don't need enriched uranium. You can get by with plutonium. And that can be chemically separated out for a lot less money than building an enrichment plant.
As we wind this up, Nuclear Hot Seat, I know, is listened to by people within the nuclear industry. People at World Nuclear News, at the NRC, and also at the IAEA. We've been able to figure this out. So, Arnie, if you had something to say directly to those still inside the industry, speaking as somebody who once was inside the industry, what would you tell them flat out directly?
Well, I used to be one of them, and I don't demonize or vilify the individuals. I was there. But there's a bigger picture beyond the one you're looking at, and it's not as safe, and it's not as robust as you really think it is. I'm appalled at what the industry's doing now. Is as these plants get older, they're seeking to change the regulations that they work under through something called exemptions. Basically, you know, you want to drive down the highway at 95, you pull in and ask the state troopers, can I drive 95? And the state trooper, of course, says yes. That's what's happening in the nuclear industry. As they bump into economic hardship, they ask for exemptions. And I think the exemption process has been absolutely distorted. So I think there's people of integrity within the nuclear industry, and I'm appalled when they choose to vilify me, but I guess that's the nature of the beast. But to the people with integrity in the nuclear industry, I guess I would say it's time to be a ship and leave the sinking rat.
Arnie Gunderson, Chief Engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education. A reminder that you will be hearing much more from Arnie from his two presentations in the coming weeks on Nuclear Hot Seat, beginning next week with episode number 338. Activist shout out! It is ironic that just 1 week after this overhyped anniversary of the start of the nuclear age, on Sunday, December 10, 2017, in a ceremony in Norway, the Nobel Peace Prize is being awarded to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. I doubt they'll be celebrating that at the University of Chicago, or even giving it notice. They'll still be too busy staring at pictures of the pretty nuclear explosion made with all those fireworks. But some people have been working very hard to bring about a day when neither the United States, China, Russia, North Korea, India, Pakistan, Israel, Britain, or France will be able to unleash the very real, very unpretty nuclear bombs that they have, and that the force of will of the majority of the world's nations and people eventually prevails in achieving the elimination of all nuclear weapons. I salute the activists who worked so hard and so long to get this far, and send greetings to those I know who will be in attendance at the Oslo ceremony, including Dale Delwar of Saskatchewan. I suspect Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation will be there, along with representatives of Don't Bank on the Bomb, and many others I've met and interviewed over the years for Nuclear Hot Seat. I am so proud of you all and what has been accomplished this far, and will be with you in spirit. Here's today's final thought, and I want to make clear that what I'm about to express are my opinions and the opinions of Nuclear Hot Seat, not those of the Nuclear Energy Information Service, its employees or board, nor any of the individuals I have interviewed for this program. At the University of Chicago Symposium, Nuclear Reaction, I felt like I was ground zero at a propaganda bomb. It angered and horrified me to see the self-congratulatory, manipulated interconnect of bombs, reactors, moneyed corporations, and academia, all echo-chambering each other into a pro-nuclear babble bubble. This presentation was a true atomic bomb, a dirty bomb, a stink bomb of assumptions that represent an entire industry that thinks it's okay to promote a technology with the potential to destroy all life on the planet. Why? Because the profits are so good? The sense of bully boy entitlement so delicious? Simply because you can? It was a party they gave for themselves in the name of public relations, recorded and uploaded to the University of Chicago's YouTube channel, where it will continue to pollute the minds of the media and future engineering students as long as the internet lives. I'm singling out two individuals for specific notice, and I am going to get personal. Chris Crane, President and CEO of Exelon, you are a piece of work. We've already touched upon the content you spewed, the lies, misrepresentation, and double talk. But we only touched upon the content and not your manner. You glowered from the stage at everyone and everything, like you were angry at the world, which would make sense, given the toxic nature of your field of employment. You personally are overweight, have the skin tone of someone whose body is starved of oxygen and in a holding pattern awaiting a health crisis, a bad haircut. According to industry standards, you make double-digit millions of dollars a year, and you still wore brown shoes with a dark suit? Dude, that is a cry for help. Your job, your area of employment, is not making you happy or fulfilled. You think it might be because somewhere deep inside, you know that in order to do this work, you sold out something dear and precious to your heart and ate the baby? And former Secretary Moniz, former Secretary Moniz. True, I have vilified you on this show in the past, but seeing you in person, I could tell that you really believe all that you're saying. It's not guile. You're at peace with it. You actually think that nuclear is a good thing. How astonishingly sad. As Arne Gunderson said, you're a smart guy. I thought you were smarter than that, and you would have figured out this mess already. Is the money really that good? Have you really turned such a blind eye to the consequences of nuclear that you don't feel you need to consider all the evidence? Or do you just need to feel that important? You know, childhood scars can be healed in much less onerous ways. If you need some good referrals, I have them. Just send me an email and it will all remain confidential, and you will get the help you need. Back to the event. There were errors and omissions all over the place. Clearly, the nuclear industry creates an alternate reality and then inhabits it. So if those of you who are on the other side of the nuclear fence from me are secure in your superior knowledge, give yourself a bit of fun and amusement. Listen to this show. If you've already listened to it, send it to others within your nuclear establishment so that they can have a bit of a chuckle themselves. Send it to everyone who celebrated CP1. Just 59 minutes will do it to listen to the show in its entirety. Hear how you are perceived by those who know enough to understand exactly what you are saying when you say it. We see what you do, and this is our voice, the one that you, University of Chicago, Exelon, and even, it seems, Ernest Moniz, are afraid to encounter. And who are we? We are your critical mass. People who want peace, health, safety, sanity, and for you to clean up your 75 years of radioactive mess, the real nuclear pile, before you dare to promote yourselves as the solution to anything other than the problems you have already created. If you have listened, perhaps part of what we have said here will stick with you, in your memory, in your craw. It will refuse to let you go. But it's okay. Let it happen. After all, you are the great and mighty nuclear industry. We're just peaceful people having our own nuclear reaction. We weren't afraid to listen to you. Come on now. We dare you to listen to us. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 5th, 2017. My thanks this week go to NEIS for inviting me to Chicago to cover the University of Chicago events and their own countering events. My gratitude to Dave Kraft and board members Linda Lewison and Gail Snyder for their wonderful hospitality. You can check out the organization at neis.org. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2017, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that the nuclear arsenal really represents a self-destruct button for the human race. So as they say at the end of Time Bandits,
it's evil! Don't touch it!
There! You've all had your nuclear wake-up call. Now don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat! It's da bomb!